Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lendman. My guest is James Petras. Oh, listeners know James well. He's been on this program many times. It's always great to have him on. He's a Latin American expert. He writes about all parts of the world. I've said it before, he's written more books than I have, double the number of fingers and toes. Maybe I think more than triple the number of fingers and toes. I think I would need two or three lifetimes to catch up with Jim. Jim, welcome. I'll just make a couple of comments and let you jump in. I want to focus on what's most on your mind. I'll just mention a couple of things that I did. This morning I put out two articles on topics I had not intended to write about. I knew about them, and I was concentrating on other things. And then a couple of things happened, and I decided I wanted to say something about it. One was on Israel disappearing prisoners. This Australian Mossad agent who they locked up in prison, and they claim he committed suicide. I kind of hinted that maybe he didn't. I'll say it bluntly. I don't believe for a minute that he committed suicide. I think Israel murdered him.
It's impossible, Steve. It was a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week vigil.
Exactly.
The police were on his observation around the clock. Secondly, in high security prisons in Israel, there is no item that you can use to hang yourself. So it's the very conditions under which, the horrendous conditions that this political prisoner was held, which contradicts the pretext that the Israelis have for murdering him.
Oh, there's
and
no
I
question
think
about
it's because he knows so much about the Mossad operations, and that he was preparing to reveal these to the Australian authorities, particularly the assassination in Kuwait of the leader of Palestinian leader.
Yes.
that turned the tide.
Oh, indeed. So he was in a specially designed cell to prevent suicide. I mean, he would have had to have been a magician to try to figure out how on earth he could do it. There's no question Israel murdered him, and it happened a couple of years ago. And the Australian ambassador to Israel was told something. I don't know what he was told, but he was told that this young man, 34 years old, Ben Zeiger, was being held. And the word was that he said nothing to his government. What a bunch of rubbish. Ambassadors keep their governments informed about everything going on. Australia knew all about it. It took Australian television, ABC Broadcasting, to break the story, and Israel put a gag order on it, and they went apoplectic when any information leaked out. So Israel leaked a little bit. Zeiger's lawyer met with him a day or so before he died, and he commented about how rational he was. And he didn't say anything suggesting a guy who wanted to kill himself. Well, Israel killed him. Who knows how many others are mysteriously disappeared
in
Israel's
prison?
Well, that's the
point. If it came out because he's Australian and Jewish. There's several points here, Steve. One, the myth, Israeli Zionist myth, that Jews don't kill Jews is out the window. This is a clear case that the Israeli Zionists have reached the extremities of even killing their own kind. And I think this marks a historical turning point. And secondly, it reveals that Israel, just like the Gulag under Stalin, uses these isolation camps and measures of disappearing political prisoners. Now, how many Palestinians and others have disappeared, and Israelis claim they don't know anything about it, that they deny that they even arrested them. There's an article in Haaretz by Levy that describes this disappearing as part of official Israeli policy.
Oh, it's so true, Jim. I mean, Palestinian lives have no value to Israel. I mean, they're murdered, they're brutalized, they're put in prison, they're tortured.
Steve, I'm writing an article now about the persecution of Haredi religious Jews. This is a sect in Israel, sometimes dubbed ultra-Orthodox that refuses to serve in Israel's occupation army. They don't want their youth to be embroiled in murdering Palestinians and committing mayhem with their neighbors. And so now, under Netanyahu and this clown that just got elected to the parliament, this new party that came in, the central plank was that the Haredi should lose their exemption to not serving in the Israeli army. And the Haredis absolutely refuse. They don't want to, quote, share the burden of Israeli wars, particularly since they have a 60% poverty rate. They are one of the most excluded groups, economically and socially speaking, and comparable to what happens to Israeli Arabs. And this attempt to recruit this from this group. Now, mind you, this is a religious group that believes in spiritual values. They go to the yeshiva, they study the Torah, they study the Talmud, they look toward people like Maimonides, the Jewish philosopher of times past, rather than reading military doctrines. They have big populations. They believe babies, not bombs. And they are a potential large pool for recruiting in the Israeli army. And all of this hostility toward them, arousing that they are draft dodgers and all this slanders, because there is widespread resentment among non-religious Jews about serving in the military. They don't want to serve. So instead of joining the Haredis in opposing conscription, they denounce them and demand that they be pulled into this noxious role of policing the Arab settlements. Now, I know you and I have significant differences on the way in which they treat women and some of their more restrictive practices. But on the issue of anti-militarism, anti-conscription, and the persecution that they're facing under Netanyahu and the alliance they're forming with this new politician that's come up through the ranks, this radio broadcaster. His name is Yared Lapid, and his party, Yesh Atid Party. Well, he ran on primarily one issue, and that is attacking the Haredis and saying that that they have to be forced into conscription. And instead of dealing with the poverty, he says they're educated illiterates, that they're lazy, they're draft dodgers, and all sorts of slanders, because the imperative of permanent warfare demands more cannon fodder. And I think we should support the Haredi, despite whatever differences on philosophical or spiritual matters. I don't know how you feel about it.
Oh, I agree with you, Jim, and I think we're in lockstep on virtually everything. I just can't imagine a significant issue that you and I don't agree on. Well, I absolutely support the Haredi's anti-militarism, but I think they need to take it far beyond themselves alone. They should take a stand against militarism in general, because Israel literally threatens the region. It threatens world peace. I mean, you could take a step back and alliance with America, Israel threatens humanity. That's a very serious thing. I mean, they should absolutely abstain from having anything to do with the military, and they should insist that every other Israeli in furthering world peace should do the same thing. And unfortunately, Israel was born exactly the opposite way. Before inception, the Palmach, before the Israeli Defense Forces became established, and young kids are literally weaned on belligerence and militarism. There are military people that show up and they teach in classrooms. I mean, these kids are literally raised to think that all this stuff is good and Israel is surrounded by enemies. It's a bunch of rubbish. The only enemies Israel has are the ones it creates.
Yes, I agree, Steve. And I think there's one thing that we have to keep in mind, and that is that the Haredis raised the question of whether to support a Jewish Zionist state. They questioned the very existence of Zionism as the dominant ideology for Jews. And I think that's very important because they claim the state of salvation will come through spiritual religious means, not by force and violence. And they have been, at least some variants of the Haredi, violent opponents of a secular Jewish state. And I emphasize that because in some ways and in some instances, they've expressed sympathy with the Palestinians and opened the door to some kind of non-sectarian state in which Jews and Palestinians, Arabs, can live together.
Well, absolutely, Jim. Israel, I'm not certain that Israel is the only state that believes only its Jewish citizens have rights. Saudi Arabia certainly...
And even in Europe, there are state-supported religions. I don't think Israel, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, all of these states have theological underpinnings, and we should condemn them. But in the context of the Haredis, I think it's very important because in the United States, they've substituted Netanyahu for Moses.
Jim, the difference between Israel and other states based on religions, and there certainly are a number of them, Muslim states, and you mentioned some European ones, but the difference in Israel is only Jews have rights, and really a small minority of Jews, because Israel is as neoliberal as America, as Britain, as France, as the most hardline neoliberal European countries. So the disparity, the wealth disparity in Israel, is really off the charts. Of all the OECD countries, I remember writing about this, the three most extreme in wealth disparity are America, Israel, and Britain. So this is horrible, and that's why there was social protest the last two summers in Israel, because people don't have enough to get by on, and several Israelis self-immolated in protest against this. And I wrote about that,
well,
too.
Well, that accounts for these... new parties focusing on the Haredis. It's a way of distracting people from their economic conditions and raising the whole issue of religion and secularism as a flag. But it's really a major sideshow here. Steve, I wonder if we could discuss the Ecuadorian elections, which are coming up this Sunday, in which Rafael Correa, the incumbent president, is according to all the polls and my own analysis, going to win against seven candidates with an absolute majority. And whatever his limitations, particularly in supporting oil exploration in the Amazon and prejudicing the environment, what accounts for his popularity is the fact that he's doubled the social budget for education and health. He's increased welfare payments by 50% for poor people, single mothers. He's built a vast network of microfinance institutions to help create jobs. He's ousted the U.S. military base in Manta, a coastal city. He's attacked the foreign debt, reducing it 60% by declaring it illegal based on fraud and abuse of borrowing powers. In other words, he's done the opposite of what Obama is proposing in the United States, what the Republicans are hoping to do. He's increased social spending using the added resources that come from steep increases in taxes on the rich and on the oil companies. And he's shown that in the contemporary world you don't have to abide by the dictates of the financial elite. You can move in an opposite direction, and you can repeatedly get reelected.
Well, it really is amazing. He certainly isn't perfect, but when you compare him to what goes on right here in the U.S., my goodness, we would make a trade dead even and be very, very delighted about it. And I know you've been critical of him in the past, but at the same time, he's doing some important things. So anything in the right direction, Jim, is very, very important. And maybe some things will lead to more things.
Yeah. Hello?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you.
Okay.
Yes, I think that it's part of this new development in Latin America led by Venezuela, which shows that you can be part of the world market, and certainly Ecuador and Venezuela sell their oils on international markets. They sign joint ventures, but they do so in a way that maximizes the local earnings, and they maximize those local earnings into social programs rather than recycling whatever is in the government treasury to bailouts and huge subsidies and mergers and acquisitions by the big corporations. You know, in a way, Steve, everyone talks about the crisis of capitalism, but when I look at the rates of profit, when I look at the trillions of dollars that they're accumulating, when I see the illegal flows of money into U.S. banks, the laundering, the criminal banking class engaging in more felonious behavior than any gang leader in Chicago, when I see all of this going on, I say to myself, this is a very corrupt system, because the flourishing of profits, delinquent behavior, money laundering, this is why the working class, the public employees, the teachers, that's why they are in crisis, not the capitalist class. And I think we should tell people there's a lot of money in this system. There's a lot of wealth available in this system. The question is that the people that control that wealth and who are accumulating that wealth have absolutely no interest other than extracting more wealth from the people. The crisis is induced from above. It's not simply something which flows out of the system.
Well, I absolutely agree, Jim, and I've certainly written a lot about that in different articles, taking a different tact in some of them, but I've written about destroying America's social contract. It is really shocking and disgusting that the richest country in the world uses its resources to enrich already rich people, to give, aside from the bailouts to the bankers, enormous handouts to corporate America, to spend more money on militarism, including homeland security, so-called, than all other countries in the world put together. And if you add all the categories that comprise defense, including homeland security and interest on the national debt and veterans benefits that keep getting cut, and all the rest of it, secret black budgets for CIA, and NSA and the rest of them, who knows how much money is spent? I think a conservative estimate tops $1.5 trillion a year. And when America complains about China maybe spending 50 or 60 or even 100 billion, it's a pittance compared to what America spends. And popular needs go begging
Steve,
at the same
time.
I
was reading about the enormous increase in crime in Chicago and the wringing of hands of all the politicians and the criminologists. But, you know, when I read about the fact that the Congress cannot approve raising the minimum wage from $7 plus to $9 something, you have an idea. Who is going to work for such a pittance? You can't rent a bed, let alone a room, on that kind of minimum wage or even slightly above it. And crime becomes an alternative in the absence of any kind of living wage. The minimum wage has actually declined over the last 5 years by 20%. In real terms, in real purchasing power terms, the minimum wage is decreasing. And there's plenty of studies to show that it doesn't affect hiring and employment. It just fattens the profits of the employers. And that's the real argument against the minimum wage, that they want to continue enormous profits for the employers, and they want to keep minimum wages down because they also affect the general wage pattern. And I think that there's a direct correlation between very low minimum wages, very low and unstable employment, and the growth of crime, because most of the crime is connected to young people. Young people can make more selling a package of dope than they can make in 20 hours of sweat labor at minimum wages.
Jim, that's absolutely true. And a real minimum wage would be a living wage. Instead of putting a fixed dollar amount on it, it should be a living wage. Well, you could put a fixed dollar amount on it, but a living wage is not $9 an hour. If you work 52 weeks a year, it probably would be a part-time job, and that would be an annual income of something like $17,000 or $18,000. A family of four in Chicago can't live on double that amount. I mean, it costs, or any other major city, New York, Philadelphia, Boston, San Francisco, you on and on and on. You can't live on that. Rent, soaring food prices, high energy costs, inflation, based on the way it was calculated in the 1980s, isn't 3%. It's more like 9%. An enormous cost. And poor people and elderly people with medical expenses, or younger families that with kids that want to go to college, it's unaffordable. It wasn't the country you and I grew up in, Jim. That's the way it is now. And instead of helping to alleviate these problems, official bipartisan policy is to make them worse. The richest country in the world. Talk about a corrupt system, Jim. I can't imagine a more corrupt one.
Well, Steve, I think there's also a dimension here of the kind of jobs. Amazon, which is one of the fastest growing retail outlet in the United States, has horrendous work conditions, extraordinarily low wages, around the minimum wage. They have horrendous speed up of work. They have everybody tied to a computer, how fast they move the boxes. They're all timed. And the turnover, the firing of workers, if they fall behind a computer, that the directed management, they say, well, you didn't pack these boxes in 30 seconds. You took 45 or 50 seconds. Well, we saw you whispering to someone 2 minutes before the dinner bell. You're fired. And there's very little in terms of health coverage. There's a tremendous number of what they call temporary workers, which are supposedly on trial to a permanent employment. Now, Amazon is one of the biggest retailers. They're closing down malls because of its tremendous growth, but it's growing on the basis of slave labor under slave working conditions. And this is one of the leading employers in growth sectors in the U.S. economy. So when we talk about jobs and a growing economic sectors, we have to look at it carefully and say that this is a return to large-scale, long-term sweatshops.
Well, it certainly is true, Jim. And whether we're talking about Amazon or Walmart or any of the big retail operations, the service jobs, the cheap service jobs, that you don't need a college degree, you don't need a high school degree, and they just want to hire people on the cheap and exploit them. I mean, it sounds like something out of Central America, Jim. I mean, really horrible stuff. And not a word about this, nothing discussed in the major media. I mean, people are so grossly harmed. I don't know how they get by. It's why poverty is so high, and unemployment, my God, people who have jobs most likely have a low-pay part-time one with poor or no benefits. And unemployment, real unemployment, again, based on the way it was calculated in the 1980s, is around 23%. I mean, this is depression levels. And Wall Street is doing well, and the stock market is soaring. Well, I've never seen a greater disconnect in my life, and I don't know how long this can go on. I think at some point there will be a moment when the music stops, and there'll be a day of reckoning for the people that are cashing in now. But they want to milk everything they can out of it as long as they can, and they can manipulate things to do it. But eventually, this system just can't go on the way it is.
Well, Steve, you're absolutely right. And one additional factor here is that the running around, that people have to work two and three jobs. They're going around on roller skates from one job to the other. And this creates tremendous stress, hypertension. And stress has a tremendous physiological, biological effect on people. It induces heart attacks, strokes. It causes high blood pressure. It leads to grabbing fast food, which leads to obesity, diabetes. Stress is really the defining character of this kind of super exploitation of labor, use of temporary jobs, low-paid jobs that requires workers to work two, three jobs. Stress, Steve, is really the major consequence, and diseases linked to stress are becoming much more pervasive. Precisely, these diseases and infirmities are happening when less and less people have health coverage. So what might be a low-level hypertension becomes it turns into a life-threatening disease because people don't have medical coverage.
Well, again, Jim, it's so true. I wrote two articles in Obama's State of the Union address, one before he gave it and one after he gave it. And here's a guy who came into office promising real change from the way things have been. His policies have been so destructive to so many people around the world and at home. And his whole address, I said in one article, was nothing but beginning to end demagogic boilerplate. And you strip his policies down, you separate the rhetoric from the policies, and you see such destructive things that have gone on for 4 years. And basically what he's promising, regardless of what he says, more of the same, worse than ever. That as bad as things are now, a year from now, two, 3 years from now, they'll be much, much worse. And this seems to be official bipartisan policy. When people need help, the benefits are being stripped away. Budget cuts are coming, not from the Pentagon. The Pentagon will get off almost scot-free, I think, Jim, from this sequester, however they manipulate it. But ordinary people will be hit hard. They're going after Medicare. They'll go after Social Security. They'll hammer Medicaid. They're going after food stamps. How on earth can they do stuff like this? And Obama doesn't just support this stuff. He insists on it.
Yes, Steve, it's a very dismal prospect, but it can be changed, as we see in Ecuador. A new political leadership, a new political movement, arousing people to understand that the wealth they're creating is there. And what's required is the political will, the political intervention that can turn the wealth, the enormous wealth that exists in America,
absolutely,
and putting it to serve the American people rather than the plutocrats.
Many thanks, Jim. Join us tomorrow, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Sunday as well, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit. Jim, it was a wonderful program. My great thanks.